Hello, everyone. So welcome to this event. My name's Chloe Garner. I'm the Artistic Director of the Poetry Festival, and I'm really pleased to welcome you this afternoon. So Glyn Maxwell is a major British poet who studied both poetry and theatre at Oxford and Boston universities. And this training in two disciplines has enabled him to create innovative work across all genres. Maxwell has written numerous verse plays as well as long narrative poems and several collections, including most recently Pluto, which he will read from tomorrow with the American poet Brenda Hillman. So that's really something to look forward to. I'm sure I'll see many of you again tomorrow. He has also written opera libretti and fiction and taught creative writing. And he's here with us today to talk about On Poetry, which is a collection of essays that, as the title suggests, are a kind of guide for anyone interested in reading or writing poetry. So for that reason, we're going to check if you've all got pens and paper, and if you haven't, you're welcome to raise your hands and wave them, and our stewards will bring you a pen and some paper, because there will be some opportunities to do some writing. So put your hands up very clearly, and we'll just make sure that... And those of you who aren't sure, fiddle around in your handbags, grab whatever you can find. I mean, people write on the back of everything. What do we write on the back of anything? Bus tickets, you've got a ticket, write on your ticket, small poems. It's the beginning of invention is finding something to write with and something to write on. So we'll just give ourselves a minute and then we'll... I should have done this bit first, actually, and then I should have begun my carefully prepared... We should have had the prepared bit and then the chaos following that. Right.
This is a book for anyone. There are as many outlooks on poetry, on poets, on poems, on poetics, as there are people who read. But my book is for anyone. So forgive me if I leap as far back in time as possible to find a place where we all agree. This far. Alert, curious, more or less naked, without language, looking out over the green savannah. And that was a leap. That's an outlook. You see an open space with trees whose branches spread out near the ground and bear fruit. You see a river or path that winds away out of sight beyond the horizon. You see a few animals. You see changing clouds. You like what you see. 200,000 years later, you'll call this outlook beautiful. But the word's no use to you now. Time after time, in the field of evolutionary psychology, the children of today, from anywhere on Earth, in test conditions, point to this picture, choose it over all others, forests, jungles, mountains, beaches, deserts, as the view most pleasing to them. What are they looking at? What are they really looking at? Well, evolutionary psychologists think they're looking at this, an open space, we can hunt, with trees, we can hide, whose branches spread out near the ground, we can escape, and bear fruit, we can eat. We see a river, we can drink, wash, eat, or path, we can travel, that winds away out of sight, we can learn. Beyond the horizon, we can imagine. We see a few animals, we can eat more. We see changing clouds, rains will come again, we can tell one day from another. And all in all, we like what we see. What evolutionary psychologists, and I, believe, is that aesthetic preferences, those things we find beautiful, originate not in what renders life delightful or even endurable, but in what makes life possible. That's the beginning of my book about poetry called On Poetry. I wanted to call it something more exciting, but the publisher didn't want it. So it was a commission from Oberon, who published my plays, for this master series where they have little books like this on specific topics, and they'd never done poetry. They'd done sort of philosophy and Satanism and law and so on, but they'd not got around to poetry, and I think I was the only poet on their books, so they said, would I do it? And it just came, I suppose that commission came 3 years ago, and it came at a good time where I'd been teaching for years and writing for more years, and I just felt it was time to say everything I'd figured out. And as you see, it's quite a small book. It's white, which is nice, because all of these books in the series are one flat colour with the black writing, so I was quite pleased to get white. I thought that meant something. But it's quite a small book, and it is everything I figured out. That's all I figured out, but it's everything's there. So it's a mixture of appreciation of what I like. It's trying to investigate why I like it. It's a little autobiographical here and there. And but I think what probably sets it apart and makes it a bit different, that's all I mean, it makes it a bit different from other guides to anything, is that I invented a creative writing class for students whose teacher is sort of a version of me, who are threaded through the book trying to understand the things I'm saying and having little romances and dislikes and so on as we go along. So I'll tell you how that came about. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read, I think, four more extracts from the book, because it's quite, as you can probably tell from the beginning, it's, on the whole, it's written in a quite a sort of, it's not written in academic language. I was told as part of the commission that it should be for the general reader, so this suited me down to the ground, as I like the general reader, and I don't really like academics. So I thought this was going to work. I thought this could definitely work. So I'm going to do some extracts, and in between the extracts, I'm just going to just show you a couple of exercises that might be useful to you as writers. Very simple, but I think they're really fruitful. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I'm going to read the bits, which is the point in the book where I decided I was going to invent a creative writing class and not just write a critical book. As when I planned to write the book, I hadn't intended to do that. So I was trying to think about, I was talking about how first lines in poems cover an awful lot of distance and take you very far away from other first lines in poems. And I thought to illustrate this, I'd pretend that, imagine myself at a celestial cocktail party where all the great romantic poets, which they'd all attended. And I'll just read the bit. This is the bit. This point, I realised I needed characters. I needed characters to be receiving this within the book itself. So, to the celestial cocktail party, you've scarcely sipped your free ambrosia served by sylphs and cherubs, when four poets come at you from each of the four walls. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Oh, talk not to me of a name great in story. Well, they are gone, and here I must remain. St. Agnes Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. I always do Keats in a Cockney accent, because when I was Walcott's student, I was the only British student among a lot of Americans who couldn't do accents. So if Keats came up, Derek wanted them to know that Keats was a Cockney and all the other romantics looked down on him, so that I had to do, my heart aches and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, this sort of thing. And if it was Thomas Hardy, I had to do a drone of thorncomb trees. And because Derek didn't know a good accent from a bad accent, so it worked quite well. So if this provides an impression of giddily changing foreground and background, silhouettes looming up and away again, fine. If this induces a migraine, all the better. What a terrible poem they would make together. What a hideous sound is made when relations are neither consistent nor coherent. But take a step with each in turn and see how a true meeting begins. Let Wordsworth guide you to the open window. He wants to show you Westminster Bridge. This is taking place in heaven, okay, so the topography is a bit blurred. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would be he of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. Now Coleridge rudely interrupts, hustles you off to a corner so he can vent for a while. If you don't let him, he might do the mariner again, and that's your whole evening. Well, they are gone, and here I must remain, this lime tree bower my prison. I have lost beauties and feelings such as would have been most sweet to my remembrance. A cockney mutter in your ear. Who let him in? Wants to tell you another story. Poor John Keats doesn't even want to be here and doesn't need you to see his face. St. Agnes Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. The owl, for all his feathers, was a cold. And now who comes limping flamboyantly across the room to take you away from all this, tell you what he knows, worldly wisdom everyone should have, his voice filling the room as he draws you towards the bar. Oh, talk not to me of a name great in story. The days of our youth are the days of our glory, and the myrtle and ivy of sweet 22 are worth all your laurels, though ever so plenty. The name's Byron, Lord Byron. Not a bad party. The point is, these are for romantics, poets consigned to a common name. And yet see how instantly four vastly separate, coherent, consistent presences draw you into faraway spheres. So having set that up, a couple of paragraphs later, this happened. So say that party really happened. The young man or woman, probably young lady, hemmed in by those four gents, goes home, assuming she extricated herself from Byron. She goes home, intoxicated by these four meetings, intoxicated anyhow, throws open her window in hope of some kind of owl song, or failing that, some moonlight. Let's call her Isabella. And she sets about writing her best poem ever. How oft at school, with most believing mind, I speak of one from many singled out, I wandered in a forest thoughtlessly, as sure as heaven shall rescue me. I heard the skylark warbling in the sky by the light of the moon. So those are six lines from six different romantics. This won't look quite so good to Isabella in the cold light of dawn. Then again, none of those lines are hers. It would have been better to have written in her diary, this bloke pointed out some old bridge he likes. A stoner told me how sad he was feeling. An emo boy had this random story. Finally, this hot guy with a limp said, hey, life's like that, and he knew of a better party. Well, she will keep going to book launches. But it feels wrong to poke fun at one's own fantasy creatures, so we'll leave Isabella to sleep it off. She and her friends and many, many like them write poems like that every day and publish them every quarter. And when they don't make sense, that's how they don't. So that was how I decided to start doing this. So I'm just going to read this slightly longer bit, which is I think it's a combination of all the things that I'm doing in the book. I've just done this thing on riddles, on the oldest form of poetry in English, the riddle. I say the riddler comes out of the mist. There are poems of mist and poems of smoke. By mist, I mean something natural that thins or parts or deepens further, something through which a shifting truth is glimpsed with joy, understanding, or spotted with fear. Mist, breathable, water going by in a cloak. By smoke, I mean man-made smoke, complex molecules conjured for reasons obscure, yet emanating from a single explicable source, clever to make, not clever to breathe. When you've blown it all away, you're looking at a shell. By the time you get what it was, you can't use it anymore. Roam the wide savannas of the Tate Modern. Breathe what's mist, smell what's smoke. To conclude on the blackness and the whiteness, and this is like page 45, so there's 44 other pages about blackness and whiteness and, you know, writing and not writing, text and silence and so on. To conclude on the blackness and the whiteness, we have to eavesdrop on one of my writing classes. That's where Isabella goes the next morning, having woken from a dream of meeting Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron and Keats at a drinks party overlooking the Thames. The river had a slope, she tells Orlando when she meets him on the way. Orlando's parents joked with their dinner party friends in the 80s about how, with a name like Orlando, what a lover he would be someday. Well, yes, he is. Ollie's in love. He's besotted with Bella, but he doesn't know what to do with it. Bella says, funny, why wasn't Shelley in my dream? Shelley wasn't in a dream because I didn't have a copy of Shelley on my table when I wrote that bit. I try to say that. And Ollie quickens his step and says, maybe your unconscious dream creator didn't have, you know, a copy of Shelley with her last night when she, like, you know, created your dream. But he's gone on too long. By now, Bella's texting someone something and they walk on in silence. Outside the creative writing department, they meet Mimi slouching on the stone steps in the sunshine, lighting a roll-up, smoke pulling out of her black lips. And here comes Wayne, miming smoking to make a point he's making about smoking. They are all assembled. Everybody's cardboard coffee cup says the same word. They're just waiting for me. A professor in Cambridge, I believe, bridled at the term creative writing when he first heard it, and retorted that he would expect a creative writer to come up with something like a new colour. You have to love that high threshold. As Bella, Ollie, Mimi and Wayne follow me up the winding stairs to room 777 for their writing workshop, each looks quietly determined to make your regular blue, green, yellow and red seem stale compromises of the clueless past. And in the interests of varsity balance, and also an apocryphal story I like to believe, I actually heard this on the radio from Seamus Heaney, I like to believe, a professor in Oxford strolling across the quad with another of his kind one day was distinctly overheard to say the words, "And ninthly..." So, ninthly, I ask for first lines from everyone. It's tried and tested, this exercise. It's very simple and always leads somewhere. So now, this is, I think I'll do this now. Why don't you write a first line? Those of you who have the gallantry to have a piece of blank paper on you and a pen, if you fancy doing it, what I think you should do is write a first line. So this can be off the top of your head. If you're completely blank, write one you did before that you've got from somewhere else. It can be that. It doesn't have to be in this moment. Just write something. I'll just ramble on while you're doing that, so you can concentrate. It doesn't have to be any good. I'm not going to read them out and ask you to. It doesn't have to be any good. It doesn't have to. So don't have that pressure on yourself. Okay, I'm going to press on, so you can carry on with that when you're bored, okay? Then I'll know how bored you're getting, because you'll be writing. So meanwhile, I'll tell you about the exercise. It's tried and tested, this exercise. It's very simple and always leads somewhere. In this case, as I'm making this up, I'll cut cards for which student came up with the best one. Wayne did. For Wayne, the whiteness is a playground and the blackness mischief. He calls himself a miscreant. He wants to miscreate, to mischieve. He composes on an iPhone and always goes with the auto-suggest. This is based on a guy I knew. This is the line he's offered the class. This is the end of the poem. I hope no one's done that. Actually, it's that way, isn't it? This is the end of the poem. My exercise is that the other three now have to pretend they wrote that and grow a second line organically from it. So here's what to do. Well, you haven't had time to write a first line by now. So what I'm going to do is explain what happens and then you'll know what I mean. But what I'm going to ask you to do when you come up with something is give it to someone else. So you'll end up looking at something you didn't write. And it couldn't be simpler. It probably sounds simple to the point of being silly, but it's not. What I try to take out of teaching in terms of creative writing, I try to take out the self a little bit so that you're not stuck with you against your own memories or you against your sense of what's true. Something is delivered to you that you didn't write, didn't think of, has come at you from that angle. Then what you're doing is isolating technique. So all you've got to go on is... cadence of someone else's world. So it's someone else's line, it's someone else's psyche and all that. And I think this is helpful because it kind of drops the temperature, right? You don't have to be thinking, is that true to what I experienced? I mean, on a first line that I've just asked you for, this is moot because it's not the same as a poem that sort of emerged out of the depth of your soul or onto the white page. But when I teach, I try to get rid of all that. So that it's really just about, what is this line in front of me? Where is it set? You know, when I'll go on a bit because you probably, when you do have something finished, give it to someone, okay? Let's do it. It's a bit churchy, but this is, it should be, things, poetry should be a bit churchy. Just so that something arrives at you. You woke up this morning, you didn't expect you were going to see this collection, these words in front. Don't ask for any explanation. Don't even ask for any explanation of terrible handwriting. Just guess, yeah? Because terrible handwriting should suffer. So just guess. And then, so just, well, I'll give you a bit more time to do that. In fact, what I'll say is the thing I just said, but in book form. So you don't really have to listen because I just said it anyway. My exercise is that the other three now have to pretend they wrote that and grow a second line organically from it. It has to sound like the same poet, the same world, the same view. Tonally, emotionally, formally, maybe non-formally, but it has to sound like the same poet. The idea is that you divest yourself of all your own prejudgments, preferences, inclinations. You pretend it was you. So then these are the sort of questions I'll ask. And this is all in book form here. On sale on that table. So, and some of these questions will seem strange and won't seem applicable to what you've got in front of you, but some of them will, and in fact, they all should be. So, is the poet indoors? Is this happening in the afternoon? Is there sun or rain? Is the poet looking at us? Those questions usually pay off. Not so much with Wayne's line, perhaps, this is the end of the poem, but it isn't meant to travel. Anyway, I'm just trying to get them going. This is the end of the poem. Ollie turns and says, "Thanks a bunch, mate. That's impossible." That's my posh voice. Bella gazes at it doubtfully. Mimi makes that sighing noise that means Wayne is pissing away her time on Earth. But they have to take it on. They have to take on its tone, its style, its pitch, and write a second line. Before Mimi can say, "Well, my next line is blank," I say, "The next line isn't blank, Mimi." I leave them alone for a while and look out of a sunny window over the rooftops, then away at some buildings in the distance, thinking of long ago. So just to expand slightly on that, is it in the afternoon? Is it sunny or rainy? There's all sorts of other things you can interrogate about any line that's in front of you. What register of vocabulary is it coming from? Is it complex vocabulary? Is it simple vocabulary? Is it Anglo-Saxon? Is it Latinate? All that, those implications. Is it light? Is it funny? Is it colloquial? Is it school playground? Is it, you know, for example, to take two famous poets, think of Dylan Thomas, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." It's oracular. It's from above, right? It's high. And then Larkin, "They Fuck You Up, Your Mum and Dad." What's that? It's like a guy next to you in a bar putting down his drink. I think I'll probably say that here. This is getting a bit tautological. But there are so many things about that line that you can investigate. Because what you're doing really is just slowing down the process of writing a poem to a sort of microscopic pace to sort of investigate what you do without surrounding it with this sort of emotional colouring that is in you yourself. And it prioritizes the technique, prioritizes the craft, essentially. The poetic encounter is a meeting in life. Let it be like that, let it be that. Whether or not I achieve that myself, only time will tell, and it won't tell me. But what I teach, all I teach, is how to aim there. This is the end of the poem. The whiteness in room 777 bristles with thought. For Wayne, the whiteness that follows the line he wrote himself is the speechless acclaim of all outsider artists. His paper looks like this now. So I'm trying not to sneeze. It's really the season. Actually, all year is the season these days. His paper looks like this now. This is the end of the poem. This is the start of the poem. It's a real smart ass this guy is based on. This is the end of the poem. This is the start of the poem. In real life, when students have finished their assignments, I ask them to sit back with exaggerated smugness so I know who's still working on it. They smile politely, but I'm genuinely asking them to do that because it's helpful. Only I don't need to ask Wayne. He does it anyway. Ollie notices Wayne has done that. He says, "It's all right for you. You wrote the first line." Wayne murmurs at his coffee cup. "Not now, I didn't. You did." He was American, this guy, that's Wayne. And Ollie kind of thinks that's bollocks, but grins. "He got me. Touché. That's why I came to uni. I knew this guy, too. In fact, this guy's based on me as a kid." For Ollie, the whiteness is time without her, Bella, Isabella. It won't always and won't be always. It wasn't always and won't be always, but it is this morning. The whiteness is what hasn't been. The blackness is what might be. The whiteness is she loves me. The blackness is not yet. The silence is Juliet's window up there. The noise is Romeo shinning up a drainpipe. And now Wayne's made that impossible with his post-this, post-that pointless foolery. This is the end of the poem. Where could it possibly go from here? Where could poetry go? But as Ollie stares down the barrel of defeat at the hands of the postmodern, by and by he starts to be aware of darker tones he can use. Now the whiteness is a cold world without poetry or love. Any blackness he has left in him is suddenly heroic, the cry of a grail knight through the fog. He dips nobly to the task, lances Wayne's full stop so it bleeds into a comma, and the fight is on. This is the end of the poem, the loss of hope, the last failing light of the crimson light in the faraway west. Ollie's not great on the line break, we're working on that. When he sits back, remembering to exaggerate the smugness because he loves to do the daft things I ask of the class, he really does feel pretty good. Wayne tried to close down the beauty in the world, but Orlando has foiled him from the heart of the tradition. Deeper magic from before the dawn of time, he remembers from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and he jots it in the margin. Isabella is sitting next to him and has forgotten he is in the world. I only mentioned that in case he was wondering. For Bella, the whiteness is luminous, lunar, something she knows at night. The blackness is a secret from her. She has no feelings whatever about Wayne's line. Sitting here isn't being a poet. This is just a class about poetry. It's not pointless. This professor knows people. He knows poets who've been on TV. He has a Wikipedia page his daughter messes with. That's cute. In her notebooks, in her room, Isabella has 900 poems she hates. But last night she dreamed she was drunk among the true poets, and all will be well. She goes, "This is the dash, end of dash, the poem dash. Death said dash, from his carriage dash. Door." Bella's favourite poet is... she remembers... Emily Dickinson. She remembers Ollie is in the world and she smiles at him when he smiles at her because she has good manners and she's written her line. Mimi is drawing a really complicated maze no one can leave. She's pretending to be the girl in Inception. She finished this exercise in about 8 seconds. "This is the end of the poem," said the idiot at the start. For her, the whiteness was expectation, and the blackness is what you can fucking do with your expectation. I say, "How are we doing, guys?" Here's how I think they're doing. Wayne is right. He's always figuring out how far things can be taken. Always in the same direction, mind, but still. Ollie's right. He feels deeply that a poem should have beauty, but so far he can only find that in the past. His whiteness needs to be stronger, blow harder in his face at the line end. That will strengthen the black, curtail his time, make it worth more. He can dig for his beauties there. And anyway, Bella smiled at him. "You think I know these people because I've taught them, but I know them because I've been them. One morning long ago in Boston town, Professor Walcott said I played melodies with my right hand, but my left hand just lay there. Another time in his tiny wooden office on a Tuesday morning in November sunshine, he surveyed a 40-line lyric I'd written about me. He'd made us memorize Dylan Thomas's short poem, 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. And, well, I'd had a birthday just that week, my 25th, so I'd done the obvious but gone on way longer. He frowned, ringed a little phrase with his pencil, and then quoted with evident scorn, 'Caving into sleep.'" Caving into sleep? Caving into sleep? Knowing what was coming, I said, "Yes, I suppose that's pretty rubbish now I look." He slid the poem back to me. It's terrific. The rest is shit. 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. Bury the dead for fear that they walk to the grave in labor. In the groin of the natural doorway, I crouch like a tailor, sewing a shroud for a journey by the light of the meat-eating sun. Dressed to die, the sensual strut begun, with my red veins full of money. In the final direction of the elementary town, I advance for as long as forever is. The students are looking at their professor, looking out of the window. Yes, sorry, Bella is right, too. She's right to love Emily Dickinson so much she can't help hanging around her room. Everyone should find a poet like that. When she gets clear of it, she'll know a ton about form, whether or not she knows anything Emily knew. And Mimi is probably a poet. She may not really be bothered, but having written, said the idiot at the start, and sat back, doodling in her book while recharging her Kindle, yawning and stretching in such a way as to make a cat seem diligent. She then suddenly shot forward like it mattered and changed it to, went the idiot at the start, because the line wasn't good enough and she really couldn't bear it. Caving into sleep? Knowing what was coming, I said, yes, I suppose that's pretty rubbish now I look. He slid the poem back to me. It's terrific. The rest is shit. 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. Bury the dead for fear that they walk to the grave in labor. In the groin of the natural doorway, I crouch like a tailor, sewing a shroud for a journey by the light of the meat-eating sun. Dressed to die, the sensual strut begun, with my red veins full of money. In the final direction of the elementary town, I advance for as long as forever is. The students are looking at their professor, looking out of the window. Yes, sorry, Bella is right, too. She's right to love Emily Dickinson so much she can't help hanging around her room. Everyone should find a poet like that. When she gets clear of it, she'll know a ton about form, whether or not she knows anything Emily knew. And Mimi is probably a poet. She may not really be bothered, but having written, said the idiot at the start, and sat back, doodling in her book while recharging her Kindle, yawning and stretching in such a way as to make a cat seem diligent. She then suddenly shot forward like it mattered and changed it to, went the idiot at the start, because the line wasn't good enough and she really couldn't bear it. Caving into sleep? Knowing what was coming, I said, yes, I suppose that's pretty rubbish now I look. He slid the poem back to me. It's terrific. The rest is shit. 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. Bury the dead for fear that they walk to the grave in labor. In the groin of the natural doorway, I crouch like a tailor, sewing a shroud for a journey by the light of the meat-eating sun. Dressed to die, the sensual strut begun, with my red veins full of money. In the final direction of the elementary town, I advance for as long as forever is. The students are looking at their professor, looking out of the window. Yes, sorry, Bella is right, too. She's right to love Emily Dickinson so much she can't help hanging around her room. Everyone should find a poet like that. When she gets clear of it, she'll know a ton about form, whether or not she knows anything Emily knew. And Mimi is probably a poet. She may not really be bothered, but having written, said the idiot at the start, and sat back, doodling in her book while recharging her Kindle, yawning and stretching in such a way as to make a cat seem diligent, she then suddenly shot forward like it mattered and changed it to, went the idiot at caving into sleep. Knowing what was coming, I said, yes, I suppose that's pretty rubbish now I look. He slid the poem back to me. It's terrific. The rest is shit. 24 years remind the tears of my eyes. Bury the dead for fear that they walk to the grave in labor. In the groin of the natural doorway, I crouch like a tailor, sewing a shroud for a journey by the light of the meat-eating sun. Dressed to die, the sensual strut begun, with my red veins full of money. In the final direction of the elementary town, I advance for as long as forever is. The students are looking at their professor, looking out of the window. Yes, sorry. Bella is right, too. She's right to love Emily Dickinson so much she can't help hanging around her room. Everyone should find a poet like that. When she gets clear of it, she'll know a ton about form, whether or not she knows anything Emily knew. And Mimi is probably a poet. She may not really be bothered, but having written, said the idiot at the start, and sat back, doodling in her book while recharging her Kindle, yawning and stretching in such a way as to make a cat seem diligent. She then suddenly shot forward like it mattered and changed it to, went the idiot at the start, because the line wasn't good enough and she really couldn't bear it. At the start, because the line wasn't good enough and she really couldn't bear it. So, have you written the poems yet? there is actually something I'm going to send you away to do, but this isn't it. It's the simplest exercise in the world, obviously. It's just to try and grow a second line organically from a first line that's not yours. I just think this is... Well, I've explained why I think it's a good thing, because there's so many things you have to bear in mind. I mean, do you think this is a rhymed poem? Do you think it has the cadence of a formed poem? All of that, to my mind, is established in the first line. The essential crux of what I teach is the difference between the white space, that there being nothing yet, and there suddenly being a first line, right? And that means that everything in the first line is the universe this is taking place in. This is the environment it's taking place in. Partly because the First World War is in the air. You know that Edward Thomas poem, Adelstrop? It's 100 years ago and 2 weeks. Yeah, it was late June, yeah. It's a fortnight ago. It's the anniversary of that. I'm going to read something that talks about that a bit, because, to be honest, this is the last time I'm ever going to talk about First World War poetry, ever, because I've just done so much of it lately. A week ago, I did a panel with Michael Gove about it. Now, that's as far as I want to go into that area. So, this is from the book. I was judging a huge poetry competition once with thousands of entries. I'm judging the National Poetry Competition this year, actually, in case you're interested, in case you think you know what I like. And a friend asked me how I could possibly get through them all. I said it took me only seconds to judge whether a poet was present. The friend was somewhat scandalized at what seemed a dereliction of duty, so I said... Actually, I didn't say, I just thought of saying later in my car. I said he wouldn't ask that question of a concert violinist. A concert violinist could tell in seconds if a student knew his instrument from his elbow. When I think of the teaching of poetry, I invoke this inner violinist. If I were a violin master at some fine arts academy, what would I think of a student who arrived at my class at 21, having decided there's nothing he or she can learn from long ago? No skills to develop, no moves to learn, no marvels to consider, nothing to steal you with its force. Okay, let's hear you play. Or if a ballet dancer thought the same, or a sculptor. Nothing to learn from work that outran time. Nothing of lasting value can come from one who thinks so. I don't think anything has or will. It's not hard to get how seductive it is finally to crash out through the gates of school into a place without constraints. The life event is bound to be echoed in the mind. That anything goes now. If it's true to you, it's true. But to feel that one is of the generation that has it right, that's making the sound that should now always be made, to behave as if the past has been corrected in your lifespan, whether that's in poetry or literature or art or public life, it offends time, the deity I go by. You don't have to venerate time like I do, like a wryly cheerful monk, for that stance to look absurd. Because some of you I'm trying to reach, who have written a few poems but have no idea how they did or why, who've not yet considered those things. I'm trying to reach those whose poems I didn't judge in a few seconds, or I did, but I judged them worth the candle, like I heard you sing in the silence, or you could hold the bow to the string. I'm trying to reach you before your mind's made up, before you've decided, before you've done a damn thing, how the damn thing is done. Before you're a somethingist, or swear by something-ism. Before you pin your colours to anything but that-ism. Before you've decided which long-gone poets were wrong all along, or which new kid on the block has been dead right for centuries. Before you start sounding how you think contemporary poetry should sound. Now, you may have a strong idea of what that sound is. We can all agree it's the sound of hundreds of birds singing. Anthologies of contemporary poetry are always called something that means the same as hundreds of birds singing. But that sound, that general quirky, chuckling, back-slapping consensus, will be, to decades quite close by, something resembling quiet. Poetry forms in the face of time. The best place to see this happen is when time is at its hottest and most implacable, a time of terror. He's gone, and all our plans are useless indeed. We'll walk no more on Cotswold, where the sheep feed quietly and take no heed. Ivor Gurney was born in Gloucester in 1890, the second child of a tailor and a seamstress. His body that was so quick is not as you knew it, on Severn River, under the blue, driving our small boat through. He sang as a chorister in the cathedral there and began composing music in 1911. His teacher, Charles Stanford, who also taught Vaughan Williams, thought Gurney was hugely talented but unteachable. You would not know him now, but still he died nobly, so cover him over with violets of pride, purple from Severn side. Having enlisted as a private soldier in the Gloucestershire Regiment, he was working on his first book of poetry when he was wounded on the Western Front in April 1917. In September of that year, he was gassed at St. Quentin. This exacerbated an existing bipolar condition, and Gurney suffered several breakdowns after the war. The last 15 years of his life, he lived in mental hospitals. Cover him soon. And with thick-set masses of memoried flowers, hide that red, wet, we are standing in a trench in the line break to end them all. Thing I must somehow forget. Were poetry to be the only surviving record of a civilization, the years of and after the First World War would tell us something terrible had come. This would be true whether or not we understood the language. Under Colchester, the oldest town in England, a stratum of charred black earth, what archaeologists call a destruction layer, is witness to the wrath of Boudicca. The forms of poetry fracture in the white heat of 1914-18. We see that change come suddenly everywhere. We see it in the body of Gurney's poem, a pastoral lyric called To His Love, singed in a flash with nightmare. The modern world seems to me to dawn with a shudder in that line break, wet thing. And we see it in this shocking revision, Wilfred Owen, devotee of Keatsian beauty, finding himself in hell, makes to some lines in Dulce et Decorum Est, turning from, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling black and frothy from the lung, and think how once his face was like a bud, fresh as a country rose and clean and young. Two, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile incurable sores on innocent tongues. Now that's a rewrite. The changes to the third and fourth line are plain to see, but run the two alternative gargling lines through your mind a while and witness Owen's honesty, his witness straining, staggering clear of decorum. Feel the poor tongue and teeth trying to process what he's seen. But we see this terrible change above all in the forms. Of course, the experimentation of Gertrude Stein and others predates the Western Front, and of course traditional forms don't vanish once the guns go quiet. But no other period of English poetry can show a tonal shift, lurch, quake, to rival this. Flame out, you glorious skies, welcome our brave, kiss their exultant eyes, give what they gave. Flash, mailed seraphim, your burning spears, new days to outflame their dim, heroic years. England, time gave them thee. They give back this to win eternity and claim God's kiss. From that to this, only a live thing leaps my hand, a queer sardonic rat, as I pull the parapet's poppy to stick behind my ear. Droll rat, they would shoot you if they knew your cosmopolitan sympathies. Now you have touched this English hand, you will do the same to a German soon, no doubt, if it be your pleasure to cross the sleeping green between. Both poets are Isaac Rosenberg, from 1914 and 1917, before the trenches and in them, poetry forming before our eyes and a rat's in the face of time. Now, the other thing, I'll just keep an eye on the time. So I'm going to read this one other thing and then ask you to do something. Something you can take away. Yeah, good. Auden makes the supreme That's enough Auden. Auden makes the supreme argument for poetic form in general, though he's making it here for meter in particular. Blessed be all metrical rules that forbid automatic responses, force us to have second thoughts, free from the fetters of self. Far along on the journey you take with poetic form comes a simple revelation. Because poetic form is natural, it resembles freedom. Not absolute freedom, because absolute freedom isn't natural, but all the freedom the creature can gain with his lonely, brave black signals in the void. This is all the difference is between form and formlessness, between a governing aesthetic and nothing. You breathe the whiteness, you know how lines have to end, you seek out words that fit the music. Your brain, freed from its dull day job of serving up the next thing you would think because you're you, delves deep into the vaults and libraries instead, the dusty sights and attics of all you've known or guessed or heard, sorting and rummaging for a word or phrase that not only means right, but sounds right, looks right, fits right. Up it comes. Now the poem is not only you, it's you and the language. It's not only you and today, it's you and time. I have an ice-breaking exercise I use at this point. Isabella and Wayne are already sitting on one side of the table, Orlando and Mimi on the other. That just happens to be the way I'm pretending it was. It's also raining outside. Mimi looks hungover, and Bella's opening a box of elaborate waxy pastries. So I say, once upon a time, all four of you people, I mean peoples, lived in harmony on a lush green landmass. Time went by, like a lot of time went by, and the landmass divided into twin continents. Over the ages, Bella and Wayne's tribe, on one continent, evolved a language with only two vowels, A and E. Meanwhile, Mimi and Orlando, whose names had mutated first to Ollie and by now was simply Ollie with an I, dwelt on their continent with a tribe whose only vowels were I, O, and U. The consonants remained the same. They both still possessed Y. Why? Why? Two roads diverged in a yellow wheel. I'll get on with it. Did they not have boats? No, Wayne. You'd think they'd have boats. No, because the sea on that planet is pure sulfuric acid. Well, Professor, that presents all manner of chemical and... Go on. Okay, Wayne, in the end they invented boats. The queen of the AE race, called Queen Arabella, and the king of the IOU folk, King Colin, separately decided to sail their fleets to the horizon and see if there was anyone else living on their planet. They met by pure chance on a little deserted island, and then, instead of infecting, enslaving, or dismembering each other, because this is kind of a fairy tale, they sat down face to face and shared an enormous smorgasbord that stretched for the entire 40 miles of this desert rock, whereupon the AE race attempted, see I'm doing it, attempted, yeah, and the IOU folk sought, God, I had fun writing this, to understand each other's cultures. What we can see right now in our beloved room 777 is just one small piece of that legendary picnic. Bella and Ollie, Wayne and Mimi, shake hands across the sea. After some hesitation, some clarification, some eating, we get down to the work of what this is about, translation. Because it turns out, amazingly, that these four peoples shared a common poetic culture. They remembered the same poems and songs and stories, only these have somewhat mutated over the ages. For a start, there were so many there from each tribe, it was inevitable that some anniversaries would be celebrated with song on that legendary day. The AE Races brass band and the IOU Folks woodwind group both struck up the same tune, but oh, what contrary strange words rang out in the tropical sunlight. Happy day here came she, happy day here came she, happy day here came Helga, happy day here came she. And at the same time, your birth hour right now, your birth hour right now, your birth hour right now, Cliff, your birth hour right now. But each embraced the other's song, for they recognized the music. Meanwhile, their diplomatic, peaceful leaders, Queen Arabella and King Colin, were praised to the skies. Oh, she's a really sweet lady. Yay, what a really sweet lady. Or cheer that really sweet lady. Hell yes, we all agree. For look, our jolly good top boy. Oh, wow, our jolly good top boy. Our cool old bountiful top boy. In unison go us. The AE race toasted their new friends with real ale, while the IOU folk did the honours with gin and tonics. Gin and tonics. Gin and tonics, OK? I didn't get that wrong. Not surprisingly, as the day wore on, things threatened to get slightly out of hand, and you could hear a few chants going up. Be near and wage war when you feel as hard as needed. Show proximity, do. Fight us if you think your guys got strong. But peace won a day, peace and Danish pastries, and the sun set on my story. I leave it to you in the graduate bar to work out the originals of these stanzas my little class came up with. Okay, this is over to you. One. I'll take his fingers on the buzzers, okay? One. Hey! Met an aged seafarer. Makes me halt, lets them by. Hey, Beardy, mad-eyed elder, why'd you halt and hassle me? And that's from the endless verses read by the aged seafarer that made me late at the party held when Angela Fackenham Tray and Edward Heffernan Dedley were wed. Two. Turning, turning in this big growing ring. High bird will know no sound of who owns him. Things go to shit. Stuff will not truly hold. Do stuff you just itch to do is cry of my world. That's from Slouching to Holy Towns. Three. You do not do, you do not do. That's no different, is it? You do not do, you do not do, not now, brown clog, in which I got stuck. My foot stuck for 30 springs, poor, thin, not risking gulp, not risking sniff. That's from Pops. This is fine for me if one of you is getting it. Four, they screw you, Ma and Pa, hell yes. Maybe can't help themselves, beats me. Bequeath you all the mess they made and add the extra garbage free. And that's from a poem called That Be the Verse. Actors can learn thousands of lines because they learned hundreds of lines. They can learn hundreds of lines because they learned dozens of lines. Exercise is exercise. One January the 1st, I started memorizing a poem every day and it just got easier each time. I stopped by the end of March because I got both lazy and busy in ways other poets would recognize. But I still know a good many. Do something every day and that interior road becomes clear, clean, swept, maintained. If it works for memorization, there's no reason it shouldn't work for word substitution, for hunting in the word hoard. Translation can get you there too, but my vowel game is good for students both on their guard and off it. I'm afraid to say it's a team bonding thing, but a team bonding thing it is. And I've not got a clue what lights go on or bells go off in the brain. I just think it's healthy for a poet to depart from him or herself, to light strings of cerebral lanterns streaming away in all directions, away from the brilliant, boring wine and cheese do of the ego, away from what you're bound to say next because you're you, lamps marching away out of reach, over the hills, into the darkness. What means what I want to say yet sounds like it needs to sound and looks like it needs to look and means what I also want? This does. So where does that leave me now? In unrivaled brimming black with words you didn't expect, echoes you couldn't foresee, matter you never chose, resonances that crept up around you to wait for your next move. This is not you, the writer of poems. This is you, the poem. This is you in the language. Not you, you in the language. Not you today, you in time. The thing you are, at that point, simply knows more than you do. To say the least, only it can get you out of there. Orlando keeps up the vowel thing for ages in the graduate pub that evening, and Bella finds it easier and easier technically while finding it harder and harder to bother. Wayne, working with his eyeball at the next table, that's me prophesying the future there, eyeball, hasn't happened yet, but you watch. Wayne, working with his eyeball at the next table, has already explained what we just had was an Ulipo class. I don't think our professor knows that, he says. Then he's off to his computer gaming module in Jobs 109, where they say he's trying to develop poetry workshop wipeouts to sell to the folk who make The Sims. Perhaps less clear as regards why, Ollie goes when Wayne's gone and they're together. Mm-hmm, says Isabella, using no vowels, because she suddenly can't remember which ones she can use or not use, or what Ollie's talking about. He's grinning at her like he does. Why class takes shape, class takes, exactly. Bella dully remembers he said he'd married into the AE tribe and had forsaken his old ways or some shit. Yep, she says after thought, stirring her drink anti-clockwise. E, can't say yep, says Ollie. AE, that's the past. Nope, says Bella, stirring it clockwise. Can't say that, that has an E at the end. Nope, says Isabella. Finishing her drink, she better get home. She wants to watch that murder thing she likes. Catch it on iPlayer, Ollie suggests. Obviously, you mean ePlayer or A-player, she points out, summoning one last drop of wit from the smoking carcass of my class all those hours ago. When Bella is gone, and Ollie stumbles into Mimi much later in some crowded night spot, and she goes, "Oi, Orlando, let's me and you get wrecked." His mind is so distracted with how many vowel mistakes she's made. What gang these days, yea, female classmate, that he fails to grasp what she was actually asking of him, and by the time he got it, she had met some strangers she played poker with till morning. This is what I wanted to ask you to do. If you want to do this, then you find at least four lines of a famous poem, and you do it either with only using AE or only using IOU. It's got to mean the same. Right, it's got to mean the same as that, like the four examples I gave you, either AE or IOU. All the same rules apply. And if you bring it to me after my reading tomorrow, I'll give you all something. But the best one, I'll sign this book and give it to you. Okay, so there's some homework in the heat. I think that's probably 3 o'clock, and it's terrific to see you all. Thank you.